The Tom Woods Show, episode 1468.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you believe in homeschooling, but you also believe in not running yourself ragged and in maintaining your mental health, then you need the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, for which I made 400 videos on history and government. Get it from me, and I'll throw in three exclusive, unbelievable bonuses you can't get anywhere else. How do you get it through me? Head over to ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. All right, I know podcast hosts tend to tell listeners things about audio that they just don't care about, but hey, I got to be me, all right? And I just want to mention, I just returned from a trip, and I stupidly put a piece of my podcast equipment inside checked luggage. So, of course, it's getting banged up all over the place and didn't work anymore. So I need to get another such piece of equipment. By the way, you may hear lightning in the background. Normally, I would wait for the lightning to subside. It's extremely loud, but I just can't wait. I got to get this thing recorded. Anyway, so in a day or so, I'll have the equipment that I want. So right now, I'm using an old mic, and I don't know. If it doesn't sound like Tom Woods showy, I'm aware of that. We're working on it. Anyway, today we're talking about Lysander Spooner and John Locke and the subject of consent, because people say, well, the government exists thanks to the consent of the governed. That's where it gets its legitimacy from. And John Locke tried to argue this too, and Lysander Spooner was having none of it. They were, of course, not contemporaries. Locke was writing in the late 17th century, and Lysander Spooner was writing in the 19th century. But they were confronted with the same problem of how do we derive the powers of government from popular consent when the people can't really give any consent formally. There is no way in which people are actually giving their individual consent, all individuals together. They're not doing that. So Locke has to somehow find a way around that. And Spooner's going to argue there really is no way around that. And that really is the fundamental problem. The unique thing about this coverage of this topic is that it comes from the government course I created for the Ron Paul curriculum. And let's just say this is not the sort of topic that comes up in a typical government course because it's just taken for granted that the state is legitimate. But I say, why take that for granted? Why would you assume the very thing that needs to be proven? Doesn't seem fair. So instead, I'm actually exploring this issue very early on in that course. So if you want to pick up that course, of course, you can join the Ron Paul curriculum, which is a homeschool curriculum, at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And if you take this course and you're an adult, you will not feel like I'm talking down to you, believe me. If you just want this one course a la carte, you don't want to join the entire Ron Paul curriculum, you can get it at tomwoodshomeschool.com. It's also a benefit if you are a gold, platinum, or diamond supporter at the supportinglisteners.com site. And it also comes with your membership if you are a master member at libertyclassroom.com. So there are a lot of ways to get this course. I list all of them at tomwoods.com/1468. And now, here we go. Hi, everybody. It's Tom Woods. And today we are going to talk about the problem of consent. And we're going to do that by having recourse to two political thinkers who are of importance on this topic. The first one is John Locke. We encountered him in one of our lessons on the history of natural rights theories. And the second one may be a new name for you, and that's Lysander Spooner, a 19th century figure. And then in between, I'm going to throw in just a brief point raised by another 19th century figure, Orestes Brownson. Now, when I say the problem of consent, what do I mean? I'm talking about the idea that people living under some government have consented to live under that government. Because a lot of times people will say, when they're talking about a democracy or a republic, they'll say, this is a free country, not like those unfree countries elsewhere in the world. This is a free country. And a lot of times when people say this is a free country, what they have in mind is that the people have consented to the government that rules over them. They're not suffering under some government that's just forced upon them. The people have chosen this government through their free consent. And this is supposed to be what one of the key factors that distinguishes a free government from an unfree one. So what I want to do with Locke and Spooner today is look at this question of consent. How is consent given by the public? Or indeed, is consent given by the public, even in what are referred to sometimes as free societies? So let's start by looking at Locke, who tackled this question in his own work. So Locke says that it's consent. It's the consent of the people. And when I say consent, of course, I mean the agreement. People agree to be governed by a particular government. He says it's consent that separates a legitimate ruler from an illegitimate one. But again, the question is, how? How do people consent? Do people sign a petition saying we all agree to be ruled by this government? If so, I've never seen any government where people did that. So how do they show their consent? How does Locke solve this puzzle? Because for him, consent is the key to making a ruler, a person in charge of a government, legitimate. When do people give their consent? We've never seen anybody sign a document saying, I hereby consent to the government. So when does this happen? Here's how Locke handles this. He introduces the concept of tacit consent or implicit consent, implied consent, that their actions indicate that they've given their consent even when they haven't expressly done so. So he'll say, for example, we indicate our consent to the government that rules over us when we accept or receive benefits from that government. So for instance, when we travel on roads protected by the government, or when we own real estate that's protected by the government, we are basically consenting to be ruled by that government because we're enjoying the protections that it provides and the services that it provides. And indeed, according to Locke, an inheritor of real estate inherits this obligation to government. And you'll sometimes hear tacit consent even today. When libertarians are engaged in political debates, people will say to them, well, you agree to live under the government just by the fact that you live here and you accept all the benefits that come from living here. So the fact that you're just, the fact that you're standing there proves that you consent to the system. I mean, that, honest to goodness, that's actually the argument, if you can believe it, that people are saying the fact that you haven't moved to another country proves that you've consented. So there are people who take Locke's view and they broaden it even further. That's basically by breathing in the country, you have consented to the government. Well, how does Locke defend this idea? Because he can go ahead and say this, that people have tacitly consented by the fact that they travel on the government roads or they own a house that's protected by the government. But how does he defend? I mean, he can state that, but that's not a defense. That's an argument, but he doesn't defend the argument. It's a claim he's making. How does he defend this claim? He doesn't directly defend this claim. He doesn't directly say, here's how I defend the idea of tacit consent. Here's how I show that people really are consenting, even though at no time do they say the words, I hereby consent. At no time do they sign any document indicating I hereby consent. He never shows us where the consent really comes from. What he basically says is, he says, it's difficult to obtain unanimous consent. It's difficult to get everybody to consent to anything. You know, because people are busy or some people are sick sometimes. We can't get them down to sign the document. And so we can't hold up civil society waiting for everybody to sign something. So we can't, it's hard to get everybody to consent. So we just sort of say that they've consented. I mean, that's more or less his argument. But the thing is that in any other contract in society, all parties who are bound to a contract have to consent to it. And it's not enough to say, well, we think you've consented because look what you're doing. You're walking on the road. I mean, there's no other contract in the world where that would be accepted. People would laugh at you if you made an argument like that. The fact that it's difficult to get everybody to consent to something has nothing to do with the issue of consent. The issue is, how can he justify this argument that people have actually consented to be ruled? Maybe they're traveling on the road because they have no choice. Maybe they're too poor to move to some other place where there are no government roads. The fact that they're walking on the road, they could be walking on the road for a million reasons. And none of them necessarily have to involve the idea that they're consenting to be ruled by the government. He also says some people recognize that we need a common judge to judge our disputes. Remember, we talked about the inconveniences of the state of nature, and one of them was we don't have a common judge. So he says we need a common judge, and a common judge of all our disputes isn't going to work unless everybody agrees to be bound by his decisions and unless everybody agrees to participate in the hearings. Well, that may be. Maybe the one judge system won't work or one legal system won't work unless everybody consents to it. But again, does that prove that they've consented? Again, all he's doing is saying it would be inconvenient
if everybody didn't consent? Maybe it would. How does that prove that they did consent? Again, he's avoiding the question entirely. I mean, this is clearly the weakest part of Locke's writing. He is not directly addressing the question at all. He's saying, well, it would be inconvenient not to have everybody consent. I agree. Maybe that would be inconvenient for you. But that doesn't prove that they did consent, of course. So again, this is just another argument from convenience and has nothing to do with consent. Then I just wanted to introduce very briefly Orestes Brownson. I wrote the introduction to an edition, maybe was it 2003, 2004, a recent edition of his book, The American Republic from the 1870s. So I know a little something about Orestes Brownson, and I just wanted to bring to the fore one of his arguments against the idea of tacit consent and all that. He says, what kind of agreement requires me to, these are his words, what kind of agreement requires me to move to some foreign land to demonstrate my lack of consent? So he's saying basically there's no other kind of agreement anywhere in society where we would say that in order to show that you don't accept this agreement, you have to move to another country and then you'll prove that you haven't consented. What kind of crazy nonsense is this? He says, there's no other agreement in the world where to show I don't consent, it would be necessary for me to go to these tremendous lengths. I mean, really. Then we have Lysander Spooner. Lysander Spooner was quite an interesting character. He was an abolitionist who was also a pro-secessionist. He thought the South had the right to secede from the Union, but slavery was also an evil and could be interfered with. He believed he helped to bankroll John Brown's famous raid, so he was a committed anti-slavery activist and a legal thinker as well. He was a lawyer. He also set up a letter-carrying business to try to compete with the U.S. Postal Service. You can imagine how the U.S. government greeted that one. Yes, I know the Constitution says the federal government can do that, but it never says the federal government is to have a monopoly on that, and that was Spooner's point. Spooner has a famous work called No Treason, The Constitution of No Authority, and one of the things he does in that book is he takes up this subject of tacit consent. He says, consent is consent. Consent has to be freely given by an individual. Tacit consent is total nonsense. People either expressly say, I agree to it, or they don't agree to it. He says, there is no other aspect of the law in which we say, well, we surmised that you agreed to it. What? Nobody ever would accept that in any other aspect of life. Why do we give the government this exception? So he says, has anyone living ever consented to the Constitution? Has anyone living ever signed it? And here's what he says. Now, he minces no words. So if you're afraid this is going to soil your ears, then block your ears now. But if you're okay about hearing a challenging idea, then here we go. He says, the Constitution has no inherent authority or obligation. It has no authority or obligation at all, unless as a contract between man and man. And it does not so much as even purport to be a contract between persons now existing. It purports at most to be only a contract between persons living 80 years ago. Remember when he was writing. And it can be supposed to have been a contract then only between persons who had already come to years of discretion so as to be competent to make reasonable and obligatory contracts. Furthermore, we know historically that only a small portion of even of the people then existing were consulted on the subject or asked or permitted to express either their consent or dissent in any formal manner. Those persons, if any, who did give their consent formally are all dead now. Most of them have been dead 40, 50, 60, or 70 years. And the Constitution, so far as it was their contract, died with them. They had no natural power or right to make it obligatory upon their children. It is a general principle of law and reason that a written instrument binds no one until he has signed it. This principle is so inflexible a one that even if a man is unable to write his name, he must still make his mark before he is bound by a written contract. And then he goes on about the practice of making their mark. It's a practice that was introduced even when people were illiterate. They had to sign things with their so-called mark. He says, the laws hold and reason declares that if a written instrument is not signed, the presumption must be that the party to be bound by it did not choose to sign it or to bind himself by it. He says, where would be the end of fraud and litigation if one party could bring into court a written instrument without any signature and claim to have it enforced upon the ground that this other man had promised to sign it, or he ought to have signed it, or had he had the opportunity to sign it, he would have, etc., etc. Yet that is the most that could ever be said of the Constitution. The very judges who profess to derive all their authority from the Constitution, from an instrument that nobody ever signed, would spurn any other instrument not signed that should be brought before them for adjudication. So that is to say, the very judges who get their authority from the Constitution would never themselves accept as binding any agreement without somebody's signature on it, and yet the very Constitution that gives them their authority has no signature, basically by any of the people today, living today. Now, what about voting? What if people vote, are they thereby showing their consent to the system? Could that be a way to show consent? Could we say, aha, you voted. That shows you accepted the system. That shows you've consented to the government. Well, he says no. He says, for one thing, not all people have been allowed to vote over the years. So therefore, we couldn't get the consent of everybody through voting because not everybody was allowed to vote. And of the people who are allowed to vote, not all of them do vote. So you have a portion of the people who are allowed to vote, and those people are only a portion of all the people. So this obviously can't be such a system. But then he says also, he says sometimes people vote not because they want to say, I hereby consent to be governed by this government. He says a lot of times people vote in self-defense. They vote because they know the government's going to take their stuff and boss them around and whatever. And they at least want to try to defend themselves the best they can with the only instrument they have. So he says this. In truth, in the case of individuals, their actual voting is not to be taken as proof of consent, even for the time being. On the contrary, it is to be considered that, without his consent having even been asked, a man finds himself environed by a government that he cannot resist, a government that forces him to pay money, render service, and forego the exercise of many of his natural rights, under peril of weighty punishments. He sees, too, that other men practice this tyranny over him by the use of the ballot. He sees further that, if he will but use the ballot himself, he has some chance of relieving himself from this tyranny of others by subjecting them to his own. In short, he finds himself, without his consent, so situated that if he use the ballot, he may become a master. If he does not use it, he must become a slave. And so he has no other alternative than these two. In self-defense, he attempts the former. His case is analogous to that of a man who has been forced into battle, where he must either kill others or be killed himself. Because to save his own life in battle, a man takes the lives of his opponents, it is not to be inferred that the battle is one of his own choosing. Neither in contests with the ballot, which is a mere substitute for a bullet, because as his only chance of self-preservation, a man uses a ballot, is to be inferred that the contest is one into which he voluntarily entered, that he voluntarily set up all his own natural rights as a stake against those of others to be lost or won by the mere power of numbers. On the contrary, it is to be considered that in an exigency into which he had been forced by others, and in which no other means of self-defense offered, he, as a matter of necessity, used the only one that was left to him. And then finally, what about, in effect, what Locke is saying, that majority rule is practically necessary. We can't get the consent of every single person. So isn't it therefore just and okay for the majority to rule the minority? Like, isn't that basically okay? We're never going to get everybody's consent. So practically speaking, isn't it okay to let the majority do what it wants? And the answer that Spooner gives is that the infringement of rights is a crime whether the perpetrator be one person or a majority. He says, if it be said that the consent of the most numerous party in a nation is sufficient to justify the establishment of their power over the less numerous party, it may be answered first, that two men have no more natural right to exercise any kind of authority over one than one has to exercise the same authority over two. A man's natural rights are his own against the whole world. And any infringement of them is equally a crime, whether committed by one man or by millions, whether committed by one man calling himself a robber or by millions calling themselves a government. Then I'll skip down to his fifth point. He says, majorities as such afford no guarantees for justice. They are men of the same nature as minorities. They have the same passions for fame, power, and money as minorities, and likely to be equally, perhaps more than equally, because more boldly, rapacious, tyrannical, and unprincipled if entrusted with power. There is no more reason, then, why a man should either sustain or submit to the rule of the majority than of a minority. Majorities and minorities cannot rightfully be taken at all into account in deciding questions of justice. And all talk about them in matters of government is mere absurdity. Men are dunces for uniting to sustain any government or any laws except those in which they are all agreed. And nothing but force or fraud compel men to sustain any other. To say that majorities as such have a right to rule minorities is equivalent to saying that minorities have and ought to have no rights except such as majorities please to allow them. And then his final argument on this point is as follows. It is not improbable that many or most of the worst of governments, although established by force and by a few in the first place, come in time to be supported by a majority. But if they do, this majority is composed in large part of the most ignorant, superstitious, timid, dependent, servile, and corrupt portions of the people, of those who have been overawed by the power, intelligence, wealth, and arrogance, of those who have been deceived by the frauds, and of those who have been corrupted by the inducements of the few who really constitute the government. Such majorities very likely could be found in half, perhaps 9/10 of all the countries on the globe. What do they prove? Nothing but the tyranny and corruption of the very governments that have reduced so large portions of the people to their present ignorance, servility, degradation, and corruption. And ignorance, servility, degradation, and corruption that are best illustrated in the simple fact that they do sustain governments that have so oppressed, degraded, and corrupted them. They do nothing towards proving that the governments themselves are legitimate or that they ought to be sustained or even endured by those who understand their true character. The mere fact, therefore, that a government chances to be sustained by a majority of itself proves nothing that is necessary to be proved in order to know whether such government should be sustained or not. So as you see, the question of consent is a very, very difficult one for governments to answer. They're reduced to saying that if you don't move to another country, you have consented to be ruled. This is not a rule, as you can see, that would be considered legitimate in any other aspect of our lives. You've consented to this just because I start punching you and you don't do anything about it. So I guess you consent to it. There's nobody who would accept that rule anywhere else in life. So this remains an unsolved problem. And as you can see, Locke sort of wrestled with it, but not very effectively. And Spooner saw this, that this was not, these were not effective arguments, and really just pummeled them into the ground. So you think about this for yourself and see if you can come up with better arguments for the idea of consent, or maybe there are no such arguments. But thanks for listening.
All right, folks, one other thing I want to tell you. I've put a number of events up where I'll be speaking in the coming months. I've pared back my speaking, but now I've actually got several events. One in September in Orlando. That's entirely, or is it September? Yeah, it is September in Orlando. That's on business and marketing. That's not going to be on libertarianism, but it's kind of exciting for me to be invited to speak on that topic. So that's September. Then October, I'm going to be speaking at the Mises Institute Supporters Summit out in Los Angeles. Then early November, I'm going to be speaking at the Ron Paul Symposium in Lake Jackson, Texas. Oh, and also I'm going to be in Vienna. It's actually November 13th and 14th. I think I've been giving slightly the wrong dates. November 13th and 14th in Vienna, 2019. I've got all the details up at tomwoods.com/events. So if you live in any of these places, that is to say Orlando, Los Angeles, Lake Jackson, Texas, or generally the Houston area, let's say, or possibly even Vienna, I'd love to have you join me at one of these events. So details, tomwoods.com/events, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.